An agenda for a new economy.
What we need to do is restore an economy that looks more like the one we used to have, that was based on businesses that are rooted in community, function within a real market framework of appropriate and consistent rules, so that you're rooting power democratically in community in economies that are able to self-organize within a framework of market rules.
That's David Corton. He'll tell us about his book, Agenda for a New Economy, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth. And the world's getting more and more crazy. We need a new normal.
I think the only way to really save the planet is to go back to where the set point is for our anthropological normal. It's not going back. We're not giving something up. We're actually just redefining what it is to be normal. And I think that if we begin to meet the basic and very deeply rooted human needs, it'll feel right again.
That's David Wan. Later in the show, we'll talk to him about his book, The New Normal, An Agenda for Responsible Living. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. After the debt ceiling debacle and the Republican debate in Iowa, it seems our national politicians have one vision of the economy, and precious little of it relates to the needs of real people. It's all about finding out ways to give more to them that have and take away from those who have less. My first guest today, David Corton, says it's all about serving the criminal syndicate on Wall Street while letting Main Street wither. That's not just destroying the middle class, the foundation of real prosperity, but also fatally hamstringing us as we confront the most serious environmental crises civilization has ever known. It's time to create a new economic model, Corton says, one that revitalizes communities, prioritizes human needs, and builds economic democracy. Corton lays the roadmap out in Agenda for a New Economy. The first edition came out in 2009, and he updated it in 2010. Former economic hitman John Perkins praised the book. He said, "At last, a book by one of our most brilliant economic thinkers that outlines the real causes of and solutions to the current economic crisis." David Corton is co-founder of Yes Magazine, founder and president of the People Center Development Forum, on the board of the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, and a member of the Club of Rome. He's co-chair of the New Economy Working Group formed in 2008 to create and advance the New Economy Agenda. Well, David Corton, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Great to be on your show, Francesca.
This is actually an updated, a new version of Agenda for a New Economy, and we'll give the subtitle also, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth. It was first published just 3 days after Barack Obama assumed the presidency. What were you hoping would happen then with that first edition, and why did you feel you needed to bring out a second one 2 years later?
Well, of course, I actually started writing the book shortly after the financial crash in fall of 2008. And the purpose in writing it was such urgency, trying to catch the Obama administration in its very first stages, was to put out the message that fixing Wall Street is not the issue. Wall Street is not broken, but rather it is a perverse, pathological, dysfunctional financial system that drives the society on a path to literal self-destruction, financially, socially, and environmentally. You know, it seemed like it was such an ideal moment to start that deeper conversation about a fundamental rethinking and restructuring. But, of course, it didn't take.
One reason it didn't take, Corton says, is because those who were put in charge of fixing the financial system were the same Wall Street insiders who helped to bring it down. But it didn't start with Obama putting Tim Geithner and Larry Summers in charge. It started way back with the wholesale deregulation of the financial sector. Corton says that created the conditions for the casino economy. It was very different before that.
You know, it's very interesting if you look back. You know, I'm now in my 70s. When members of my generation were growing up, you know, I recall, you know, my dad had a business in our local community, a small town. It was a music and appliance store. And he had a direct relationship with our local banker, you know, and our local community bank. It was a bank that was locally owned. It had no branch banks anywhere. So it was totally rooted in our community. And it was in the business of funding local business people like my dad. Now, that system was held in place by very strict regulations and rules that came out of the Depression and were intended to make banking, the money system, function like a public utility in service to the community. So the ultimate goal was not to make as much money for bankers as possible, but it was to finance local business. Now, with deregulation, the constraints were taken away, and the banking industry consolidated, and banks were allowed to make loans across state lines. And as the ownership became consolidated, and these banks came together into ever larger banks, you know, then leading to the infamous too-big-to-fail Wall Street banks, the whole focus of the system, its whole purpose, shifted from funding productive Main Street businesses, providing real goods and services, to funding speculation, as the Wall Street players realized that you know, they could make a lot more money by playing financial games, you know, doing things like the mortgage-backed derivatives, and by pumping up financial bubbles. In the 90s, the high-tech bubbles, and then later the housing bubble. And it's so amazing that they so distorted our sense of the nature of wealth and the purpose of the financial system that it seemed like most people involved in the system came to really believe that if you're making money, you are creating wealth and adding to the well-being of the society.
Talk about the difference between money and wealth.
Yeah, you know, in the book I refer to money as phantom wealth. And it's an extraordinary thing because, you know, it's no secret if you step back and look at it. Money is nothing but an accounting entry. It is created out of nothing when a bank issues a loan, and it simply puts a number in your account, which is a liability on its books, and then makes an entry for your promise to repay, which is an asset on the bank's books. And that creates new credit or new money, essentially, with a couple of strokes of a computer key. Real wealth, of course, consists of things that are real value, you know, food or land, labor, knowledge. It's important to note the very most important types of real wealth are things like love and peace and a caring community, a meaningful job. These are the things that are so essential to our well-being. But money is just an accounting entry. But when we get entranced as a species and a society into believing that if we're increasing the size of those accounting entries, we're somehow getting wealthier as individuals, as communities, as a nation, then our whole economic system becomes very distorted, as our system has. And we begin to orient all our policies to what's going to most increase the numbers in our bank accounts rather than focusing on what is essential to improving the quality of life of all Americans and ultimately of all the world's people. And it leads to very different decisions about how you use resources. I mean, it's so extraordinary that if one really understands GDP, you realize that this indicator that we devote our total national being to trying to accelerate its growth is really just a measure of the rate at which money is flowing through the economy and can be thought of as a measure of the rate at which we are transforming real useful resources into phantom wealth financial assets. As one looks at how this dynamic is destroying the real living wealth of the planet, you know, one can imagine a future in which the landscape is totally barren. There are no people, there's no trees, there's nothing living, but what you have left is a few banks with computers still churning out interest payments on their accounts and growing their accounts.
Well, that's a dystopian vision.
Yeah. it kind of tells the story.
it does. But explain if you can, why the decision to get rid of Glass-Steagall, to tear down the wall between the investment banks and the community banks, you know, depository banks, that's the word. Why did that lead to this casino economy? And in fact, you go further than casino economy. You actually call it a criminal syndicate.
Yeah, I guess that term's criminal syndicate's a little questionable because most of what they were doing was totally legal. But that, of course, is only because they had sufficient political power to change the rules to make it legal. But it's an interesting question. You know, in one of my earlier books, The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community, I trace out 5,000 years of human history and how roughly 5,000 years ago we moved from relatively more egalitarian societies to a consolidation of concentrated power into hierarchies of domination, societies in which a few people control the wealth and property and manage it to their exclusive benefit, essentially holding the rest of the society captive to their interests. And that pattern played out beyond the classical kings, emperors, and empires into our modern era, where increasingly the control was wielded through the control of money systems and finance and corporations, rather than just through the power of occupying armies. There's a segment of the population that continues to believe that social order depends on rule by an elite class, that the more you concentrate wealth and power in a small ruling elite, the stronger and more prosperous the society. We've also created a whole system of economic thought that is so built around the idea that making money is creating wealth that it provides a justifying ideology for the Wall Street folks who have been intent on changing the rules of the game to facilitate that concentration of wealth and power. Now, the interesting thing is that they do it in the name of the market, of free markets. But in fact, the dynamic that unfolds out of this is fundamentally anti-market and anti-democracy.
You say it's anti-market and anti-democracy. Is the market inherently democratic? Or I guess the question I'm really asking is, do markets tend to concentrate power in small groups of people just by their nature?
Yeah, it's interesting that the simple answer to that is that an unregulated market tends to morph into a non-market economic system ruled by corporate monopolies, which is, by my understanding, the exact opposite of a real market economy. And of course, we all tend to turn to Adam Smith as our guru of the market. And I think that's valid. But by my reading of Adam Smith and The Wealth of Nations, and reading it in the context of his other major work, The Theory of Moral Sentiments, it's quite clear that the market that Adam Smith had in mind looked a whole lot more like our local farmers market, where local farmers and consumers get together and engage in exchange. It looks a whole lot more like that than it does a global economy ruled by Goldman Sachs, Walmart, and Monsanto.
So what David Corton is saying, and what he writes in Agenda for a New Economy, is that the corporation is an inherently destructive anti-market business form.
You know, when I studied economics, the ideal of the market economy was defined by pure competition, which meant that a total deconcentration of power, so that no single enterprise could influence the market price on its own. You know, which in theory is the way a farmer's market operates if you've got enough farmers there. Now, the dynamic of the market, if there are no rules to limit the concentrations of economic power, it does tend to concentrate, because you inevitably in a market have winners and losers. As you get more concentration of power, that gives more capability to the winner to manipulate the market, and that concentration will tend to continue until you've got a market organized around monopolies. Now, this was the kind of dynamic you tended to have before the Great Depression, which resulted in putting in rules that limited the concentration of power, and rules that tended to enforce the fundamental principles and assumptions of a real self-organizing market economy, which can only exist, in my view, within a framework of rules. Now, that put constraints on the profitability, the potential profitability of corporations that are publicly traded, which gets into another set of dynamics. Adam Smith's ideal was a small enterprise in which the same person is the owner, the manager, and the worker. And that person lives within the community in which the enterprise is operated and manages the firm within a basic moral framework, which is the essential framework of what Jesus taught as the foundation of Christianity. Fundamentally, treat your neighbor as you would have your neighbor treat you. Fundamental code of most all the world's religions. Now, as you begin to concentrate corporate power, and then you move to a system of trading and share markets, you move to a total separation between ownership, management, and workers. You also disconnect the owners, who, by the theory of our economic system, are the ultimate decision makers and the people that are entitled to make the decisions for an enterprise and to reap the rewards of its profits. They become as totally connected from the actual operation of the enterprise, and the enterprise itself, its driving dynamic and values, become totally disconnected from the well-being of the community and the consequences of the firm's action on real people, particularly when you get in public trading and the split second speculation on price movements in the corporation. You turn the time frame not to the long term health even of the enterprise, but toward the very short term profit returns to whoever the owners of the corporation may be at that particular instance.
Corton says the government mechanisms that were created to support local banks were taken over by the deregulated Wall Street banks and subverted.
Part of what's going on here, which is really interesting, is that, when we had this system of local banks, we designed a support system for those banks because they were providing a real community service. And that support system, included arranging the Federal Reserve facilities to secure the liquidity of local banks, and groups like the Federal Insurance Deposit Corporation to insure their deposits. It makes a lot of sense to provide potential federal subsidies and guarantees for a money system that is functioning as a public utility in service to the real Main Street economy, securing local prosperity. But as that system morphed into a system of concentrated power in Wall Street banks, and the purpose of the system shifted away from supporting a real wealth local economies to simply generating profits for Wall Street bankers, those guarantees stayed in place and those subsidies. So now we have a system of subsidies and guarantees for this casino that, as you noted, I characterize as a criminal syndicate. And there, of course, is no justification whatever for public subsidies and guarantees for that. Now, in terms of the answer, you know, it's interesting and not so complicated that in broad outline, what we need to do is restore an economy that looks more like the one we used to have, that was based on businesses that are rooted in community, function within a real market framework of appropriate and consistent rules, and a financial system based on local financial institutions that are owned by local people, preferably organized under a kind of mutual or cooperative model, like our mutual savings and loans used to be, and our credit unions, so that you're rooting power democratically in community and economies that are able to self-organize within a framework of market rules.
We're talking with David Korten about the new edition of his book, Agenda for a New Economy, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth. And we're just getting right now to the real wealth part. You've actually set up what you call a new economy working group to help bring this vision into reality. And this is, to me, some of the most exciting, because I really have a lot of trouble trying to figure out how do we get from here to there. And yet, you point to ways in which this new economy is already beginning to grow. What are some of the mechanisms of this new economy that already exist?
Well, we still, fortunately, have a number of smaller community banks. We have our system of credit unions that is strong and actually seems to be growing in strength, partly perhaps as a result of the Move Your Money campaign.
Move Your Money campaign? What is that?
That's a campaign that urges people to move their deposits, their banking deposits, from Wall Street banks to local banks and credit unions that are actually rooted in their community and locally owned, and recycling their credit in the community. So as that's expanding, there's a call not only to move your deposit to local financial institutions, which strengthens them, but also to move your borrowing and your credit card. And then the next step is encouraging institutions, including groups like churches or local service organizations, local governments, even state governments, move their banking accounts and their borrowing to local banking institutions. That's just gaining enormous national momentum, and it will not in itself change the system, but it's a powerful kind of voting with your feet, and it's also very educational as part of raising people's awareness of the importance of the local economy and local financial control.
That's
but
great.
I think of the larger shift in terms of a three-part strategy. The first element, that any foundational social change begins with a new story, a conversation, around a new idea, a new possibility, a different way of organizing things. So, the first is a kind of a self-education process of, oh, yes, many of these things that we've been told we depend on Wall Street for and for global corporations, these can actually be done with greater real efficiency and more responsive to our needs if they're built around local businesses. That facilitates and supports the development of relationships of community, which are essential to both our security, resilience, and our sense of happiness and well-being. The second element is to create the new reality, build the new economy from the bottom up through grassroots action, which also in turn then helps to change the story. But where we see that local action is in groups like the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, the American Independent Business Alliance, that are organizing local businesses to assert themselves, to develop business-to-business relationships among themselves, to rebuild the building blocks of our local food systems, our local financial systems, local energy systems, and so forth. which then begins to give people more options as to where they work, where they shop, where they invest, which involves in literally redirecting their life energy from support of the predatory Wall Street system to the support of their local economies and their local communities, which weakens Wall Street and strengthens Main Street. As that process develops a demonstration of possibility and helps to shift our understanding of our economic possibilities and the fact that there is a whole different way of organizing economic affairs that is more democratic, more in line with real market principles, and more satisfying and resilient, then you build the political base for the third element of the change, which is changing the rules. And that's, you know, that's changing the policies, reversing the policies that the Rubens and Summers and Geithners advance to remove restrictions on Wall Street so that it could function more efficiently as a criminal syndicate, but turning those rules back so that they actually enforce basic market principles like prevention of monopolies, a more equitable distribution of wealth, the internalization of costs, all these basic foundational market principles, enforcing those so that communities can organize their own resources in ways that meet their own needs and not incidentally bring themselves into balance with their local ecosystems.
It's so interesting what you're saying, because in a way it turns on its head the common idea of how change happens, which is that you have to go and change government first. You have to change the rules first in order to allow change to happen in the real world. And you're saying, no, we need to start the change now, then change the rules, and then go to the next stage of changing reality.
Yeah, that's kind of the political reality we face. Mm-hmm. I have no objection to starting with changing the rules, but as we've seen it in a system that's dominated by the wealthiest players, it just doesn't happen that way. And of course, the big players also control the media and thereby control the public story and the education of the public as to what the purpose of the economy is and what our economic options are. We have to counter that with essentially a grassroots education process that plays out partly through these actions on the ground.
So in terms of that, you know, it seems to me that the market fundamentalists have been very good in framing the simplistic story that what's good for Wall Street is good for everybody else and we need them anyway. Basically, that idea of trickle down, we need these guys. Is there a simple message that can get people where their gut is? What is the language we need to start using?
Framing our messages in a more powerful way is an important part of the work. I think part of it is getting our religious institutions, our faith institutions, engaged in a dialogue about basic ethics and about the prophetic role of religion. That whole underlying logic that says what's good for Wall Street is good for America and good for ordinary people is based on such an absurd and morally perverse logic that if you begin to unpack it in a conversation, it totally falls apart. Now, essentially, what market fundamentalism says is that we're best off by creating institutions that give a small elite control of the world's biggest and most powerful corporations, which then, in turn, control the productive assets of the world, control our politics through the funding of political campaigns, and control our thoughts through mass media. And these corporations manage for the sole purpose of increasing the financial assets, the profits, of their strongest players. And then you create a culture through the media controls that says it is in fact the civic and ethical duty of the members of this elite to to use their power to maximize their personal financial gain without regard to the consequences for others. And this will result in the best results for the rest of the society. Now, once you lay it out in those terms, it's pretty clear how absurd the underlying logic of the current system is, both just in terms of practical common sense and in terms of morals. And once it's unpacked, if you still believe the story, then, you know, I've got some AAA-rated mortgage-backed securities that I'd like to sell you.
Exactly. Well, David Corton, this has been just a fascinating conversation, and I really feel we've just skimmed the surface. So I'm going to tell our readers to go read your book, Agenda for a New Economy, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth. Go read Yes Magazine, which you can find online and also subscribe to, because there are all kinds of articles there. There's a whole new economy section which talks about the ways in which people are really putting this into practice. And last but not least, go to CSR Wire, where people can further the conversation, can comment on your ideas, and really try to start spreading those ideas.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a joy and a privilege to be on your show, and I trust we will continue this conversation.
David Corton is the author of numerous books, including The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community, that was published in 2007. You can read summaries of the chapters of Agenda for a New Economy by going to writersvoice.net. We've put a link there to David Corton's blog series about the book, published at csrwire.com. Full disclosure, I'm managing editor of CSR Wire's blog, Talkback, where the series posts. Next up, we talk with David Wan about his agenda. It's all laid out in his book, The New Normal. That's coming up after the break. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. David Wan says the biggest threat to America is the American way of life because it puts the quantity of our stuff ahead of the quality of our lives. Yet we cling stubbornly to our ways, addicted to affluenza. That's the title of the best-selling book Wan co-authored back in 2005 with John DeGraff. His new book seeks to answer the question, how can we actually make the shift from affluenza to a sustainable and affordable society? It's all about creating a new normal, changing our social software so it can meet the economic and environmental challenges we face. And far from depriving ourselves, we'll find we're happier and more fulfilled, Wan says. His book, The New Normal, An Agenda for Responsible Living, lays out a 33-point platform to break our addiction to a suicidal way of life and make the shift to one that's rich in time, health, and meaning. David Wan, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
You start the book by reminding us that we're kind of running out of everything. You say it's up to us to change the rules of a game whose end point is collapse. Can you first give us the briefest definition of what a paradigm shift toward responsible living would be?
I think the only way to really save the planet is to go back to where the set point is for our anthropological normal. It's not going back. We're not giving something up. We're actually just redefining what it is to be normal. And I think that if we begin to meet the basic and very deeply rooted human needs, it'll feel right again. Right now, it doesn't feel that good to us. I really like the idea of Max Neff, a Chilean economist, talks about nine human needs that have always remained constant throughout human history and over the course of all cultural change. What changes and what goofs us up is the fact that the way we meet those needs changes. And right now, the way we're trying to meet the needs is by going way around Robin Hood's barn kind of thing to get basic things like security and safety and participation, expression, identity, freedom. We keep trying to have material things meet those needs when really all we need to do is go directly to the needs and support each other and create a society that knows if, for example, we can remove the inequality in our society, we're going to remove a lot of stress, and we're going to remove a lot of the need to be sort of frantically looking around for material rewards and trying to fit into a world that really right now doesn't make sense.
I'd like us to go into more detail about the vision that you have. And I thought it might be a nice way to do it would be to go just on page 5 of your book. I'm going to read out what you list as the old paradigm, and then I'm going to ask you, okay, what should be the new normal? The first thing up on the list is the perpetual growth of capital is the goal of our economy. What would be the new normal on that one?
Well, I think what we need as a civilization is not growth but maturity. That's the way natural systems work, and I think the protection of the source is really key in operating any successful and sustainable economy. And so we need to preserve the systems and the good quality of life, health, and affluence of time. Those are the goals. We've gotten distracted by the money. It's like a weapon of mass distraction. You know, we're just so much on the theme of if it makes money, that's good. Well, that's not good. It's destroying us.
So that kind of goes to another point in the old paradigm, is there's an emphasis on quantity, on appearance or image. What would the new normal be?
Well, we seem to be sort of dancing on the surface of life in both experience, products. We're looking totally at what the individual gratification can be. And we have to get back to the idea, as an ancient Greek person, Marcus Aurelius, said, that which is not good for the beehive can't be good for the bee. So we have to get back to an emphasis on things like quality and durability, precision and flexibility that enable humans to be their best.
Can you give us an example of how emphasis on quality or durability, what would be an example of that, and how can we do that, bring that into our life?
Let's delve into a system, the food system, for example. Food production systems are rewarded by agricultural subsidies by the bushel and not by the quality of the farm, not by the nutritional quality of the food. It's all about the way the apple looks and how big it is, rather than how much nutritional value it has. So we're missing the point there, and in food, as with many other things. We happen to have the cheapest food as a percentage of our national income, but we have the most expensive health care. And the correlation is just very direct, as Michael Pollan expresses it so well. You know, we're kind of missing the boat on all the money that we could save if we prevented disease with better nutrition.
So then let's talk about throwaway mentality, one-time use, products not repairable. That's the old paradigm. You talk about closed-loop, continuous recycling mentality. What is that?
A lot of the geologists will tell you that within 40 or 50 years, just common metals like tin and lead and zinc and steel and so forth, iron ore, will obsolesce in terms of our ability to mine them economically. So what I call an affordable civilization really gets to the idea that, you know, since we're part of nature, why don't we do it the way nature does, which is that we continually reuse materials so that we don't have to plunder the system to get more. And so the intelligent way to run an economy and a civilization is to get beyond this addiction we have to a throwaway mentality. To me, it's, as a person who studied biology quite a bit, it's obvious that a biological system learns how to weave partnerships among species so that we don't have to go and import anything. That we everything we need is right here if we take care of it. Mm-hmm. So our current way of thinking about convenience and so forth, really, which is about a 150-year-old habit of throwing stuff away, it just can't work. One very concrete example is the idea that we think about aluminum cans as being something that's very recyclable and so forth, and you'll save 90% of the energy by recycling an aluminum can as opposed to making it from scratch. Well, it turns out, as Lester Brown points out, that a glass bottle that's used 5 or 6 times is 10 times more efficient than even a recycled aluminum can. So we have a new metrics emerging where we say, you know, it's not just miles per gallon that I want, it's people miles per gallon. How many people traveled how far in this efficient car? We're thinking about a metric that says, how much oil does it take to get that barrel of oil? And that's something new. This is something that's emerging that we're not going to have to say, well, it's all according to just, you know, we'll just make a choice based on what we want. Well, in the future, we're going to be making a choice based on how much energy it costs to get it, based on how much nutrition and health it supplies. We're going to be going for the real stuff rather than just the money stuff.
I've recently been spending a lot of time in my mother's house. My mother's 90. She's in assisted living, and I'm hanging out with her things that are, you know, date back to the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s, because she never throws anything away. And a lot of those things were things that were repairable. They were made so that the consumer could actually repair them or could bring them into a repair shop and get them repaired. Is there any indication that some of that might be coming back, or can we bring that back?
It's already here in certain things like the Volvo, for example. I drive an old Volvo, and it's got 300,000 miles on it, and it delivers some of those human needs that I was talking about directly. It's always ranked as being one of the safest cars. It gives me a sense of security since I don't have payments to make and since nobody in their right mind would steal it in a parking lot. I mean, it's durable and has intrinsic value because of its great design. I happen to think that design is a sort of a cornerstone of how we're going to turn this whole thing around. When we begin to reward good design again, like you were mentioning, my mother's same as yours. My mother's 89 and lives in assisted living. And until last year when she sold it, she still had a featherweight Singer sewing machine. And, you know, 55-year lifetime, that's great. That's what we want. We want the durability. We want something that just is so solidly made that, you know, it sort of speaks to the idea of the pride of the people who own the company that made this.
We're talking with David Wan. He is the author, co-author of the runaway bestseller, Affluenza, and has now come out with a new book, The New Normal, An Agenda for Responsible Living. So the kind of company that you're talking about that we need to transition to is one, you say, which in where the mission of the company or the mission of business is actually to produce quality goods and services, as opposed to the mission is making a profit. I mean, you're not saying that the two things are necessarily opposed to each other, but how does one get to be a company whose mission is to produce quality goods and services? And have we been here before?
Yeah, I think the idea that a company mission is to make money is something that has actually become embedded in legal statutes now. You know, a corporation it's illegal for a corporation, for example, to sell to a hostile takeover that's not going to give them the best return. And that's what you're looking at. That's what happened to Ben and Jerry's ice cream. They got taken over by somebody who made such a good deal that they had to take it. And to me, that's absurd. I mean, we're looking at value in a very backward way in that case too. A company should make a profit, and it should also provide a product that does have this durability and resilience and intrinsic value. It should also be a good neighbor with its community. It should also be a place where people love to come to work. It should be a place that supplies health care facilities right in the company. It's been proven that companies that actually go that extra mile to have this be a wonderful place to work, they don't have to go out and recruit new workers. A good company is about abundance. And I love the example in The New Normal. I talk about Judy Wicks and her restaurant in Philadelphia called the White Dog Cafe. She made that restaurant into a way of life And every morning she would read a little sign in her closet that said, "Good morning, beautiful business." And she would think about all the people who were out getting ready to make the, who were out in the field already, growing the stuff that would come to her restaurant, and all the people who loved to come to the restaurant because it felt good and they felt healthy after they ate the food. So my point is, it's not about just one thing or another. It's about holism and the idea that value, sure, we can make money, but that's not gonna really satisfy us in the long run unless we're thinking that we're really proud of the product that our company makes and the way we're treating our fellow workers.
You say that there are kind of three avenues towards this new normal. One is systems redesign, which is what we've been talking about to some degree here. You also say political engagement. And then finally, a cultural change, which is probably the most fundamental. Talk a little bit about this political engagement. How does this fit into the new paradigm of the new normal?
We want to participate. As humans, we want to feel like we have a voice and that we're part of it. I think that we've somehow split ourselves away from the power that is naturally given to us by democratic principles. Democracy is one of the most beautiful things that the world has ever seen, and it's an expression of everyone's equal here. Your voice counts just as much as mine, and we really had to fight to get that. Women didn't have the vote until, 1919 or something like that. The fact is, we worked hard to get this democracy, and in order to maintain it, we have to participate.
What are some of the ways that that change actually happens? That are there things that we can do that can increase our political participation? I mean, I think a lot of people just say, sure, participate, you know, you get on a website or, you know, send a letter to your congressman or write a letter to them. But, you know, that doesn't really seem to work very well when you're trying to go up against the power of the lobbyists who have real money in their hands. What kind of political participation can shift the paradigm to the kind of new normal you're talking about?
Well, and I am talking about a cultural revolution, which I'm not talking about violence. I'm talking about something where all of a sudden it just clicks that now we're headed in a different direction. One of my favorite statements is Gandhi's, speed is irrelevant if you're traveling in the wrong direction. And I think that's what's going to happen. We now not only see the light to a certain degree, but we feel the heat. So my vision of what we can do politically has to do with the idea of getting different goals and priorities put out there before us. And these are things that Republicans and Democrats and libertarians and everyone can agree on, that we want healthy kids, that we want nature on the rebound, that we want to jump out of bed rather than crawl out of bed, that we want health, you know, that these are things that we can all agree on. And I think the way that is most fulfilling is to work in your own town and your own state. I think we're going to see a return to regionalism and communitarianism, you might call it. What's important is the voice that I have in my neighborhood and in my city. I feel especially proud of the idea that I was on a sustainability committee in my hometown here of Golden, Colorado, and I proposed a solution for recycling that something like 5,000 other communities already have. It's called pay as you throw, where you can throw away all you want, but you're going to be charged by the volume for what you throw away, and we're not going to charge you for what you recycle. And I proposed that, and I felt a real sense of empowerment that, by God, my idea was taken by city council, and they said, that's a good idea. And so I think, again, if we can get involved in those things that are directly related to our own quality of life, then that'll give us a sense of empowerment. And then we can move forward from there to say, why shouldn't the whole nation have this?
You also talk about something like green chemistry. Well, first of all, what is that? And how does that fit into this shift in cultural consciousness?
Green chemistry is something that's in its infancy. It is a type of chemistry that doesn't take a lot of energy to produce. It's produced at room temperature. It doesn't have all the pressure and the high temperatures that petrochemistry has, because to take the petroleum molecule and break it up into constituent parts that you can use, you have to really put a lot of energy into it. So natural chemistry says, let's find a different pathway. I remember in the book Deep Design, I wrote about how you get a nylon comb. And you could get a nylon comb by using chemicals that come from, I think it was cornstarch, and not have to go through the benzene pathway that is very toxic and you end up with all kinds of toxic wastes. It's a way of rethinking chemistry, and it's going to take a long time to evolve, but just such simple things as soybean ink is an early example. And so green chemistry is something that's very exciting to me as a sort of a first book I wrote was Biologic, and I've been very much involved in the idea of how do you design with nature, the way nature designs. And there's something, have you heard the term biomimicry?
I have, but why don't you tell our listeners what that is?
Biomimicry is also something that's very exciting to me. And peacock feathers, for example, are not actually, when you look at a peacock's feathers, it's not dye in the feathers that you're seeing. It's the way that the light is refracted through those feathers. So by looking at the way nature lubricates and insulates and lets light through and heals itself and does all the things that it does, we already have a complete inventory of products that would be, you know, very much in alignment with nature and wouldn't be producing all this pollution. I firmly believe that we can have a culture that provides twice the satisfaction for only half the resources, and that's one of the tools we can use, biomimicry.
We're talking with David Wan. His book is The New Normal, An Agenda for Responsible Living. It's about creating a new paradigm, one that lives well within, ecologically within the living systems. Now, I wanted to ask you also, you talk about the way that we are going to have to do a whole lot of restoration. I mean, we're not only using up the earth, we've also destroyed large swaths of it, and we're creating climate change, which is speeding up the numbers and the intensity of natural disasters we have. You say that there's an emerging market for natural restoration. Talk about that. Is this something that where companies can do well by doing good?
Absolutely. There is going to be a new way of thinking about it. We need the culture to come along and really embrace this, though, too. All over the world, there are examples of, let's say, people who are living on forest land, and they're being paid not to destroy the forest because it's worth it to the downstream users to protect the water, for example, not to have soil wash into the rivers and downriver. As a matter of fact, the whole country of China discovered that. They started paying people who lived in the mountains to preserve the trees rather than having them cut down and having the Yangtze and Yellow Rivers and so forth cost billions of dollars to clean up the mess that they'd caused by stripping the lumber off the mountains. So I do think that there are ways that natural restoration can pay its way. Let me give you a few more examples. One biologist computed that if we would restore the wetlands along the Mississippi, and I think it's 13 million acres, which is a lot of land, but if we would spend about the same amount that the flood of 1993 and 1994 cost, you know, because of the Mississippi flooding, we could actually come out ahead. So if we think preventively and restoratively, then we can save ourselves money. Another example is marine reserves are becoming very well proven out as a way to have fish protected in a certain area, and you can't fish there. And you come back in 10 or 15 years, now all of a sudden you've got abundant populations of fish just by leaving them alone and letting them regenerate. Because the fact of the matter is that something like 40% of the world's native populations of fish are in serious decline. We can think that technology is always going to bail us out and we can be very optimistic and so forth, but it's not going to work to have better fishing boats and better nets and sonar equipment and ships that can refrigerate the fish so you can be further and further out. Technology can't solve a problem that's really based on the idea that the fish aren't there anymore. We're going to find that our arrogance about the ability of technology to solve all problems just ain't true. That we're going to have technology that bends a little bit, is flexible, is ingenious, and is able to understand how natural systems work and thereby be sustainable.
David Wan, as you look about you, just right now at this present time, what is the greatest source of the hope and optimism that you feel?
Well, I really think that we can learn. I just wrote a little blog piece day before yesterday about what happens in one piece of the human brain, and that is the nucleus accumbens, or the reward center. The reward center is designed to say, well, that's good. I want to do more of that, so I'm going to release some dopamine into this human body and reward it for that kind of behavior. And it turns out that, yes, it's true that sugar and, you know, gratuitous sex and fast-paced images on television, you know, those things do cause hits of pleasure and release this dopamine into our body. But what is more important and what is cause for me to feel like we're going to make it is that what we really feel good about and what makes us self-induce this pleasurable feeling in ourselves is cooperation, teamwork, generosity, bonding between people. I think the idea that social capital, when it's wisely spent, you know, the more that you spend, the more you have. And I don't know if people know what the term social capital means, but it's about bonding and support and the whole idea that it's not just about me, it's about us. Social capital is something that can substitute for monetary capital. Natural capital can too. Human capital can too. If we provide health for ourselves, if we increase our skill levels, if we begin to say, we're going to do it in a different way now because, after all, there's more and more humans and there's less and less resources. And we're thinking about it just the other way around in our old paradigm. We're saying we're going to try to put people out of work by using more technology, use fewer and fewer people, when really what we're trying to do is use more people because we have more people and less.
That would be a great solution to unemployment.
It absolutely would. I really promote a full employment of a part-time workforce, which
that
is a different
great
way of saying a three or four-day week at most. And that would keep people at work. And is that some kind of a fairy tale? No, because the European Union already does that. And in Holland, up to 40% of people are part-time workers. They want the time. And so I guess that's a long-winded way of saying we're backwards in thinking that productivity is always good if we can put people out of work.
Mm-hmm.
What we want is craft. We want to bring people back to work and use more people and use less destructive, in many cases, technology. So what I'm saying, Francesca, is that if we turn around some of the basic assumptions, we're going to come out ahead. And it's going to resonate with us because it's anthropologically correct.
The book is The New Normal. We've been talking with the author, David Wan. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
David Wan is president of the Sustainable Future Society and a fellow of the National Simplicity Forum. You can read his comparison of the old paradigm to the new one at writersvoice.net. And you'll find a link there also to a new grassroots organization that's trying to create the political will for the new economy and the new normal agendas. It's called the American Dream Movement. It's meant to be a progressive alternative to the Tea Party. Find out more at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.